Hello, everyone. Welcome once again to the WHO free teleclass series on infection control, kindly hosted by Weber Training. I'm very pleased today to introduce my colleague, Professor Sanjay Sant, to deliver one of the key teleclasses of this year program on the following topic: implementing change, the technical and social adaptive aspects of preventing catheter-associated UTI. As you may know, Professor Sant works at Ann Arbor VA Medical Center and is professor of medicine at the University of Michigan Medical School. Among the many topics he focused on within his career, obviously UTI are a prominent one, as well as catheter-related bloodstream infections. Indeed, for these topics, he's the special liaison to the CDC's Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee. It is very important to know that his research also focused on key aspects of implementation science and quality improvement and patient safety. This is because these are one of the reasons why we really wanted, as WHO Patient Safety Department, him as a special speaker within our teleclass program. Therefore, Sanjay, I let you start and go on with your presentation. For the audience, I would like to let you know once again that unfortunately we are unable to take questions. We will see if there is any time at the end for a short discussion between me and Professor Sant. But in any case, if you have specific questions, you can find an email address to which to send them on Weber Training. Thank you very much for attending, and please, Sanjay, go on.
Thank you, Benedetta and Paul. It really is an honor to be with all of you this afternoon to talk about implementing change, the technical and socio-adaptive aspects of preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infection, or CAUTI. On slide 2, I quote a famous Florentine who was an advisor to the Medici who understood how difficult change was. Those of you who have tried to implement change in your own facilities realize it is not for the faint of heart. And in fact, Machiavelli wrote 499 years ago, quote, "Nothing is more difficult to plan, nor more perilous to conduct, than the introduction of change. The innovator has for enemies all those who have prospered under the old, and only lukewarm defenders in those who may prosper under the new. When his enemies have the opportunity to attack, they do so with the zeal of partisans, while supporters defend him feebly, endangering both the innovator and the cause." So whether it is preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infection or central line-associated infection or ventilator-associated pneumonia or other hospital-acquired infection, for those of you who are interested in implementing change, you realize it can be quite challenging. On slide 3, I make it clear that consistently implementing evidence-based practices in general remains a challenge. On slide 4, it's a paper from the New England Journal of Medicine which indicated that United States adults receive only about half of recommended care, and that quality varies by the particular condition. On the next slide, I focus in on healthcare-associated infection. And as you can see in the systematic review of nearly 100 studies done by Erasmus, the overall median compliance of hand hygiene compliance among healthcare workers was only 40%. Lower rates in physicians compared to nurses, and lower rates before patient contact rather than after patient contact, since healthcare workers are more likely to wash their hands afterwards for reasons related to self-protection. On the next slide, slide 6, I discuss that given this gap between what should be done and what is done, there has been a focus on an emerging science known as implementation science, which is defined as the scientific study of methods to promote the systematic uptake of research findings into routine practice. This term, implementation science, goes by different definitions in different areas, but in general, the synonyms are T3 translation, knowledge transfer, and knowledge utilization. They're all referring to fundamentally this same entity of figuring out how to take research findings and applying it to practice. So the next slide, I ask the question, how can we better implement evidence-based practices in infection prevention? As Benedetta mentioned, that has been the focus of the research of our group for about a decade. And on slide 8, I'm going to focus on two important components of implementation, the technical aspects and the socio-adaptive. The technical aspects are the evidence-based practices that are published in peer-reviewed journals and that are recommended by CDC and other authoritative bodies. But once we have figured out what the evidence is, we cannot stop there. The next step is to try to understand how we can actually take those technical practices and make sure that every time a patient needs that intervention, it happens. And that's where the socio-adaptive component is so important. And our focus will be on catheter-associated urinary tract infection. So let's turn now to some background on urinary catheter-related infection. On slide 9, urinary tract infection causes about 35% of hospital-acquired infections, making it one of the most common, if not the most common, hospital-acquired infection in the world. Most are due to the use of indwelling or Foley catheters. Up to 25% of hospitalized patients are catheterized sometime during their stay, and catheter-related infection leads to increased morbidity and increased costs. On the next slide, I describe the clinical manifestations of CAUTI, which vary widely. Asymptomatic bacteriuria gives no symptoms, but some patients, a small proportion fortunately, can die because of overwhelming sepsis from a urinary tract source. More commonly, symptomatic UTI occurs in patients who have infection, which may lead to lower abdominal, suprapubic, or flank pain, or systemic symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, or fever. The next slide, I go through the pathophysiology of how urinary catheter-related infection occurs. And this is important to understand because prevention affects these different steps. Organisms enter the bladder by one of three ways. First, at the time of catheter insertion, underscoring the importance of proper aseptic insertion technique. And once the catheter is in place, bacteria or other organisms can then enter the bladder through the catheter lumen or intraluminal spread from a colonized drainage bag, which sometimes will be colonized because of frequent emptying with poor hand hygiene practices, for example, or disruption of the closed system. Or then finally, bacteria or other organisms can colonize the external surface of the catheter after having colonized the perineum and migrate along the catheter mucosal interface along with which would be the extraluminal way of spread into the bladder. On slide 12, whether it's intraluminal or extraluminal, the organism now is in the bladder. It leads to an infection with inflammation, which now leads to three different consequences, which all lead to either symptoms or evidence of infection. The first is that the detrusor muscle of the bladder can go into spasm, which leads to leakage of urine around the Foley catheter. Second, you can have shedding of cells within the catheter lumen, which leads to obstruction of the urinary catheter or a positive urinalysis. And finally, the bacteria can transmigrate from the bladder into the bloodstream that can then lead to bloodstream infection, which could present with fever or hypotension or low blood pressure. Given the important clinical and economic consequences of catheter-associated urinary tract infection, prevention is very important. And on slide 13, I go through four of the key approaches to preventing CAUTI. We'll take these one at a time. Slide 14 focuses on the most important rule, and that is to make sure that a patient really needs the catheter. Unfortunately, study after study after study has found that urinary catheters are often used inappropriately. In this slide, on the left side of the slide, have the appropriate indications that the CDC put out in the early 1980s. While these have been updated, they haven't changed dramatically, and I will show you an updated list in a few minutes. But using these criteria, Jane and colleagues on the right side of this slide found that the initial catheterization was unjustified 20% of the time. But more importantly, as they followed patients every day of the urinary catheter, up to half the days that a patient had a urinary catheter, it wasn't justified. So we then asked the question on slide 15, why are catheters used inappropriately? We hypothesized that perhaps physicians just forget that their patient has a urinary catheter, since the drainage bag may be obscured by the bed sheet and the genitourinary exam is not part of the daily physical of a hospitalized patient, nor should it be. So we determined the extent to which doctors are aware which of their inpatients have urinary catheters, and we surveyed 56 medical teams at four sites across the United States. And on the next slide are the results. So one reason catheters are used inappropriately is that physicians just forget that they're in place. When we asked medical students who had patients who had urinary catheters and asked them, does your patient have a urinary catheter, 18% of them were unaware of the catheter's presence. House officers, which are medical professionals who have graduated from medical school and are now in training, were unaware 25% of the time that their patient had a urinary catheter. And attending physicians, the ones who are really the head of the team, who are both medically and legally responsible for the care, were unaware 38% of the time that the catheter was in place. The other thing we found is that in about 30% of the patients who had urinary catheters, there was no documentation anywhere in the medical record that the catheter existed. There was no physician note mentioning the catheter. There was not even a physician order for the catheter, even though one is usually required. It wasn't in the nursing note or no other nursing documentation, but we knew it was there because we could see it poking out of the patient. So we've actually called this phenomenon the immaculate catheterization to describe this phenomenon that patients have catheters and we don't even know looking at the chart that they exist. So how does this occur? Well, on the next slide, slide 17, urinary catheters often are placed in the emergency department, and what we found in a national study is that catheters are often inserted without clear indications, and they may remain in place for convenience rather than for medical necessity. In fact, an infection control nurse told us, quote, "Our other barrier is the emergency department, and this is where most Foleys are placed. Doctors forget to look under the sheets to say, oh, yeah, there's a Foley there, and the nurses aren't going to take the initiative." So rule number one is to make sure that the patient really needs the catheter. On slide 18, I have the updated list of appropriate indications from the United States Centers for Disease Control, based largely on experts' opinion. So the next slide is the importance of adhering to general infection control principles: aseptic insertion, proper maintenance, hand hygiene, education, and feedback. On slide 20, I'm going to focus on aseptic technique for catheter insertion. There are many different educational videos available. The two that I've cited here are from the New England Journal of Medicine and are generally of very high quality. The most important thing to understand is that the goal should be to avoid contamination of the sterile catheter during the insertion process, and that we should not assume that healthcare workers inserting urinary catheters know how to do so. In studies we've done at our place here in Michigan, we have found that often either a nurse or a physician or a medical student who's inserting a catheter is not using proper aseptic technique. On the next slide is just talking about what this insertion technique entails. Hand hygiene, of course, is very important both before and after placement. Aseptic technique should be used with the use of sterile equipment, which includes sterile gloves, a drape, an antiseptic solution for cleaning the periurethral area. And we should use the appropriate catheter size, the smallest size catheter that we could use and still have it serve its purpose, primarily to prevent mechanical complications of the putting in the urethral catheter. On the next slide, I focus on once the catheter is in place, it should be maintained properly. And this means keeping the urinary system closed to the extent you can and making sure that the flow is unobstructed, that the catheter is not kinked, that the tubing is not kinked. The drainage bag should always be lower than the bladder to prevent seepage of urine that's been sitting either in the tubing or the bag back into the bladder. And the bag should be regularly emptied, again, using proper technique with appropriate hand hygiene. So once the catheter has been determined to be indicated, it's been inserted using proper technique, it's been maintained appropriately, we should now remove the catheter as soon as possible. And on slide 24, I go through a recent meta-analysis that looked at the 14 studies that have evaluated urinary catheter reminders and stop orders. In some cases, these were written reminders or computerized reminders or nurse-initiated protocols to remind physicians that their patients had a urinary catheter and ask them or essentially say that because it meets no indication, it will be removed unless you object. And what these 14 studies have found is that there was a statistically significant reduction in catheter use by about 2.5 days, a statistically significant reduction in infection by about 50%, and importantly, there was no evidence of harm, in this case, harm being reinsertion of the catheter. On the next slide, slide 25, is another way of thinking about this, and that is the urinary catheter has a life cycle. And one way of preventing infection is to disrupt the life cycle. And we do this by preventing unnecessary insertion and making sure that it's done properly. Once it's in place, we maintain awareness and proper care of the catheters. The third step is prompt catheter removal somehow. And the fourth is once it's removed, to prevent replacing the catheter. On slide 26, I just highlight the fact that prompting catheter removal actually has the most data supporting it, and that's why it has been the focus of national efforts in the United States to reduce catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Once we've done these various steps, we should now consider other methods of preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infection. And on slide 28, I'm going to introduce the concept of the possibility of using advanced technologies to prevent cowdy using antimicrobial catheters. In fact, there have been different antimicrobial urinary catheters that have been evaluated, silver either in the form of silver alloy or silver oxide or nitrofurazone releasing. On slide 29, I summarize the results from a Cochrane review that looked at 23 trials involving over 5,000 hospitalized patients. And what they concluded was, quote, silver alloy-coated or nitrofurazone-impregnated urinary catheters might reduce infections in hospitalized patients, but the evidence was weak. Larger, more scientifically rigorous trials are needed on whether catheters impregnated with antibiotics or antiseptics reduce infection. And one of these trials is hopefully will be reported soon. On slide 30, I give you an overview of an 8-center trial that's coordinated by the University of Aberdeen that compared standard catheters with either silver or nitrofurazone for those who required short-term catheterization. In addition to outcomes such as cowdy, this study will also be looking at costs and quality-adjusted life years, or QALYs. It's funded by the United Kingdom. And the website, which I checked a few weeks ago, indicates that the paper is at the editorial review stage. I do not know what the findings are, but this would be an important study to determine how useful antimicrobial catheters can be. On slide 31, I talk about alternatives to the indwelling catheter, and these would include things like the bladder ultrasound scanner, which is a non-invasive device that will help determine how much urine is in the bladder. And the reason this could be helpful is if a hospital does not have access to bladder ultrasound scanning done by the nurses, if a patient gets admitted to the hospital and is not urinating, what sometimes will happen is that a urinary catheter will be placed because the fear is that the patient is obstructed, especially if it's an elderly patient who's a man and who may have a large prostate. Once the Foley catheter is placed, it's now the care provider now realizes that the bladder is empty because there's very little urine in the bladder, and they decide to fluid resuscitate the patient. But since the Foley is there, they decide to keep it there to make sure that the patient is able to urinate. So this would be a way of having more patients catheterized than really need it, because if you were able to use a bladder ultrasound scanner, the nurse would be able to detect that the bladder was empty, and even before putting in a Foley, the patient would receive plenty of fluids and would only receive a catheterization, in some cases an intermittent catheter, only if the patient had a large amount of urine in their bladder and was not able to void on their own. So portable bladder ultrasound scanners can reduce initial insertion of the Foley catheter and should be considered. Second, the use of intermittent catheters should also be strongly considered, especially in patients who require long-term catheterization and those who have injured spinal cords. Those are the groups that have been best studied with the use of intermittent catheterization. Either the patient or a healthcare provider, like a nurse or a nursing aide or a family member, would insert and remove the catheter several times during the day. And based on studies, this does decrease the risk compared to a Foley catheter. And finally, the use of condom catheters in men has been studied in various trials. Only one randomized trial has been done, but based on quasi-experimental and this one randomized study, in appropriate patients, so men who do not have bladder outlet obstruction, and men who are able to keep the condom catheter on without removing it constantly because of delirium, these patients have a lower risk of infection with the condom catheter compared with the indwelling catheter. And in satisfaction surveys, men prefer condom catheters over Foley catheters. There have been many recent guidelines on catheter-associated urinary tract infection. I have highlighted Several of these guidelines from the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America, Infectious Disease Society of America, and then on page 34, the large guideline and very comprehensive and well-done guideline from the CDC was published in 2009. On page 35, I've provided a concise summary of the recommendations of what most of these guidelines have in common, and these would be many of the things that we've discussed. Adherence to infection control principles remains very important, including aseptic insertion, proper maintenance, hand hygiene, education, and feedback. Bladder ultrasound may avoid the indwelling catheter and should be considered, as should condom or intermittent catheterization in appropriate patients. Do not use the indwelling catheter unless you must, and often those interventions will require the partnership with people in the emergency department. And finally, early removal of the catheter using reminders or stop orders appears warranted. It not only will prevent catheter-associated urinary tract infection, it will also prevent the non-infectious complications of urinary catheter use, such as immobility and pain and discomfort. And on the next slide, I've given you a simple mnemonic or memory aid to remember the five key principles of preventing CAUTI, and this would be the ABCDE approach to preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infection. So let's shift gears a bit, and on slide 37, go from the technical aspects in terms of what the specific practices are, what's the evidence supporting those practices, to the socio-adaptive component, and this has to do with once we know what we should be doing to prevent infection, are we actually doing those things? And if not, how can we make sure that we are? So on slide 38, we ask the question, what are hospitals using to prevent CAUTI? And we conducted a national survey of U.S. hospitals. We focused on the three most common device-related infections: central line-associated bloodstream infection, ventilator-associated pneumonia, and catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Surveyed the same 700 hospitals in both 2005 and 2009, and the lead infection control professional filled out the survey, and we got a reasonable response rate of about 70% in both years. And on slide 39, I give you an overview of recently published data which shows what U.S. hospitals are doing to prevent CAUTI. And again, these are national random sample of hospitals, so it's nationally representative. Bladder ultrasound scanning increased from 2005 to 2009. Reminders or stop orders also increased, but still is only 21%. Silver alloy catheters are used in 40% of U.S. hospitals, and condom catheters were not used much in 2005 and not used much in 2009. So the next slide really highlights the fact that there's really no dominant practice being used to prevent CAUTI, even though CAUTI is one of the most common healthcare-associated infections. And only one in five U.S. hospitals are using catheter reminders or stop orders, despite pretty good data to support its use. So the next step, then, is to evaluate a statewide initiative where we've tried to implement change at the level of an entire state. And our focus has been to reduce urinary catheter use. So slide 41, I give you an overview of what we have found. And this was working with the Keystone Center of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. This was the same center that coordinated the large study on central line-associated bloodstream infection that was published by Peter Pronovost and colleagues in the New England Journal in 2006. The focus for this study was on reducing urinary catheter use. And what we found was that having daily reminder and daily assessment, primarily from the nursing staff, led to a 25% relative decrease in catheter usage with a 30% relative increase in appropriate catheterization. And there's also some evidence, which is unpublished data that we have from the CDC, that while throughout the United States, rates of catheter-associated urinary tract infection have gone down by about 6%. In the state of Michigan, the rates of CAUTI have gone down by 25%, which is a statistically significant greater decrease in CAUTI rates in Michigan during the time of this three-year initiative compared to what was happening in the 49 other states. On the next slide, I talk about some of the key themes that we've learned, because as we've evaluated the Michigan experience, we have conducted site visits and phone interviews with many of the important leaders at the hospitals, as well as frontline individuals, to understand why some hospitals were more successful than others, and for some of those hospitals that were not that successful, what the problems were. And the three themes, and I'll talk about them in more detail in a moment, has to do with tailoring of the intervention and implementation strategy. Second, making sure that catheter removal becomes part of the workflow. And third, highlighting the importance of leadership. So next slide focuses on the importance of tailoring. You may need to tailor or modify your approach to CAUTI given your specific context and circumstances. In fact, we saw different solutions at different hospitals. We even found different solutions within different units at the same hospital. Even though much of the work in quality improvement focuses on hospitals as if they are kind of single entities, those of us who work in hospitals realize that the surgical intensive care unit can be very different than the medical intensive care unit, and an ICU is very different than a floor patient, and on the floor, it's very different than the emergency department. So the examples of tailoring would be, who should assess for catheter appropriateness? Should it be the morning nurse, the afternoon nurse, the night nurse? Sometimes you may have to modify the indications for catheter use slightly. Some hospitals believe that patients with acute kidney injury and have low urine output should receive a catheter. Others would say those who have severe exacerbation of congestive heart failure and are being diuresed should receive a catheter. While there will be disagreement over those indications, hospitals may decide to modify the CDC appropriate indications given local expertise. And finally, should you focus on insertion and avoiding the insertion or removing, or should you focus on early removal, or should you focus on both? If you focus on the insertion process, then the units that have to be included would be the emergency department and the operating room, since in most hospitals, the vast majority of patients who receive catheters would receive those catheters in those two venues. However, if the focus is on early removal, then the focus will primarily be on patients on the regular floor or patients in the ICUs prior to being transferred from the ICU onto the floor. So those types of modifications will need to be thought about carefully. Next, I talk about workflow. So on page 45, we discuss the challenge, which is how to make urinary catheter removal part of the everyday workflow, especially the everyday workflow of nurses. Ideally, the interventions should become part of the workflow of what nurses do every day. We heard a lot of stories about nursing workload and how what a big issue it was. And you should realize that since Foleys can be easier for the nurses, this may be a disincentive for nurses to remove the Foley catheters. On the next slide, if the focus is going to be on the emergency on insertion, the emergency department is critically important. We visited some hospitals where the routine course was that they needed to get a urine sample, and in order to do so from a patient, they would put in a Foley, and since the patient already had a Foley put in, they would just leave it in. Another hospital the ED nurses thought that they were doing the floor nurses a favor by inserting a catheter so that the floor nurses wouldn't have to do so. And the other important aspect is that nursing aides often insert Foleys in the emergency department, and some of them are able to do so quite well and are trained to do so and have their competency of insertion assessed, while others do not. And so I think that if you decide to focus on insertion, the emergency department will be an important area to focus on. And then finally, leadership is very important. On page 48, I talk about the importance of leadership. And it's not leadership just at the CEO or hospital director level, but at various levels of the organization. For Cowdy, we found that nursing leadership was critically important, given what I've already discussed about issues related to nursing convenience and therefore keeping the Foley in perhaps longer than it's needed. But physicians often play an important role as well, especially behind the scenes in terms of getting buy-in from medical executive committees and other physicians if you're going to put in place a nurse-initiated removal protocol. And physicians on the front line, hospitalists and hospital epidemiologists, can also be very valuable partners as you put forward your Cowdy prevention initiative. On the next slide, it'll be important to understand that the type of champion that you will enlist to lead your Cowdy initiative will depend on the organizational culture. In some cases, it'll be the nurse manager. In other cases, it'll be the charge nurse or the infection preventionist or a quality manager or a hospital epidemiologist or another physician. So this will not be a one-size-fits-all strategy, that there will need to be some modifications depending upon history and the culture of your organization. But having said that, leadership generally is an important issue. And on the next slide, we've written a paper about the four key behaviors that effective infection prevention leaders exhibit. I wanted to go through these briefly with you. And this has to do not just with physician leaders or senior executives, but nurse leaders and hospital epidemiologists and others. And the first is that these individuals tended to cultivate a culture of clinical excellence. They had a clear vision of what they wanted to accomplish, and they conveyed that to staff. Second, they tended to be inspiring individuals. They motivated and energized followers, and not all of them were charismatic, but because they were considered terrific clinicians and people with very high integrity, people tended to follow what they had to say. On the next slide, the third key behavior that they exhibited was that they were highly solution-oriented. Rather than focusing on complaining about barriers, which often will be easy to do since there are so many barriers in hospitals, they focused on overcoming those barriers. And when there was resistance, and I'll talk more about resistant staff in a moment, they dealt directly with the resistant staff rather than avoiding those sometimes challenging conversations. And finally, they thought strategically while acting locally. They planned ahead, and they did the necessary politicking in order to move things forward. I'll just give you one example. A chief of medicine at a hospital told us that he would never bring up a vote in a committee that was important without knowing that he had the votes ahead of time. Because once you have failed in bringing up a vote, it's much more difficult then to resurrect that issue, since people think of it as having gone down to defeat. He would rather withdraw the proposal and then come back when he had more support. So those on the next slide are the key qualitative UTI themes that we learned from evaluating the Michigan's county experience, and you may face some of these similar barriers in your own work. However, you may also face two additional hurdles. And on page 54, I talk about the first of these two hurdles. And both of these hurdles have to do with human beings. So one type of hurdle are individuals who are known as the active resistors. And while they tend to be both, they can be both nurses and physicians, in our experience, the active resistors tended to be physicians, especially surgeons and especially anesthesiologists. And they prefer doing things the way they've always done them for the simple reason it's always been done that way. However, even though they exist and they're often the ones who bring up issues at meetings, I would actually say that they're helpful in that there are ways to overcome active resistors, not just through leadership, but especially for physicians. The data will be key. The data will set you free, especially if it's a well-done study in a high-impact journal that you can present and say that this is what we want to do at our place. That can be a very powerful driver. The second hurdle, which is much more challenging to overcome on the next slide, are people who we refer to as the organizational constipators. Again, they can be both physicians and nurses. However, in our experience, they tended to be more likely to be nurses than physicians, especially directors of nursing and chief nursing executives. And they tend to be mid-level to high-level individuals who are passive-aggressive about change without actively resisting it. So they say the right things at meetings, you think they're on board, but you realize after 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, even longer, that things are not moving forward because they've languished on this person's desk. Identifying these individuals are the first step in overcoming organizational constipation. Usually what most of us do when we confront this is we develop a workaround. And that is helpful for the first one or two initiatives. However, in time, we think through all the different steps when someone asks us to lead an initiative, and we then decide that it's not worth it because we have to overcome some of these individuals. And the problem with organizational constipation is the people who know that their constipators are usually at their level or below, the people above them are unaware that they're kind of blocking up the entire system. Another approach to dealing with organizational constipators, and this was told to us by a hospital director, which initially sounds counterintuitive, but it actually was successful at this site, is that rather than keeping the initiative away from the constipator, which is what we try to do often because we don't want the constipator involved, that this hospital brought that person in very early and had this person kind of think it was their idea. And so that rather than constipating it, they would actually be promoting it. So this is another approach that could be useful to overcome organizational constipation. But I will say that overcoming the organizational constipators is much more challenging than overcoming the active resistors. So finally, my last few slides are the conclusions. And on page 57, let me just summarize some of the key take-home points that I made during the last 45 minutes. The first is that catheter-associated urinary tract infection is a common and costly patient safety problem. It's one of the most common healthcare-associated infections in the world. Second, fortunately, several practices likely decrease cavity, but there are no easy solutions. While I've given you the ABCDE approach to preventing CAUTI, none of those interventions will be powerful by themselves. perhaps the most important intervention when it comes to the data will be early catheter removal or using a stop order. But even then, implementing it will require socio-adaptive solutions. I do believe that avoiding the indwelling catheter should be prioritized because that prevents both the infectious as well as the non-infectious complications of urinary catheter use. And early removal, as I've mentioned, has robust evidence to support its use and should be something that every hospital will be able to do. For hospitals that have electronic medical records and computerized physician order entry systems, this would be reasonably straightforward and would require some programming of the computerized physician order entry system. For those hospitals, and most hospitals even in the United States do not have electronic medical records or actually do not have computerized physician order entry, having some type of a written reminder that goes onto the chart could be useful, or some type of a nurse-initiated protocol so that nurses follow patients every day and they're assessing those patients to see if the patient still needs the catheter, and when not indicated, would then communicate with that patient's physician to see if it can be removed. And then finally, this whole issue of implementation. Implementation has two key components, the technical and the socio-adaptive. And we spent plenty of time talking about both. You actually need to have both, unfortunately, often in medicine, because within each physician lurks a scientist, and we're more interested in the technical stuff. That alone often is insufficient, and therefore there needs to be plenty of attention paid to the socio-adaptive. How do you actually take an early removal reminder and put it into the organization and make sure that it works? And sometimes that will require a deep understanding of the implementation process and tailoring as appropriate depending upon the hospital and depending on the particular unit. One size is unlikely to fit all. And so don't be surprised if the approach that you find useful in your hospital will be a little bit different than the neighboring hospital. So finally, on slide 58, is the most important take-home message is that preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infection is a team sport. Physicians alone cannot do it. Nurses alone cannot do it. Infection preventionists alone cannot do it. Senior executives alone cannot do it. It will require coordinated and careful collaboration between all the different key individuals and groups in a hospital in order for this to be successful. In many ways, we have used catheter-associated urinary tract infection as a window for peering into how well an organization runs. Because preventing CAUTI, which is kind of a mundane infection, but something that's clearly important, tells us a lot about physician and nurse communication and collaboration between frontline practitioners and senior executives, how well the infection preventionist is able to work in different parts of the hospital, such as the ED, the floor, and the ICU, and the operating room. And hopefully I've used the word nurse as often as I've used the word doctor, because those two clinical groups will be critically important to prevent catheter-associated urinary tract infection. And finally, the last slide, I want to thank you for your time and interest in learning how to prevent catheter-associated urinary tract infection, and also let you know about a website that we've developed through funding from the National Institutes of Health. It's a free website called catheterout.org that has much of the material that I presented today, plus additional material, including detailed protocols if you want to put in place various types of CAUDI initiatives, either focusing on insertion or removal or both, as well as information on how to engage physicians, nurses, administrators, and data collection tools that you may find useful. Back to you, Benedetta.
Thank you very much, Professor Sanjay Sant, for this brilliant and very inspirational presentation. I have to say that during your talk, I was taking notes and a couple of questions came up, but throughout the presentation, you really already answered to these two questions I had. In particular, I thought it was very interesting, the second part, although I think it's always very useful for all of us to hear again about the technical aspects that you pointed out in the first part. And I was, as usual, fascinated by the concepts that you are so good at explaining, although they are complex in their nature and implementation. So these concepts about behavioral change and how to overcome barriers, in particular with resistors and constipators, and how do we and do physicians in particular become leaders in this field and other fields. So I don't have particular questions. I think that many of the concepts that you explained can be applied to other fields in infection control. Maybe would you like to make any small comment on this aspect? Because I know and I'm sure that you have a lot of experience in translating these concepts, for instance, in hand hygiene improvement or other fields. Am I right to say that?
Yes. No, thank you very much for your comments, Benedetta. I would say that, as I mentioned, while I think it is important to focus on catheter-associated urinary tract infection, given how common it is and how it can lead to significant morbidity, mortality, and costs, we actually have found it very useful to apply some of what we've learned in preventing CAUDI and CLABSI to other hospital-acquired complications, both infectious and non-infectious. And I'll give you a couple of examples. First, focusing on central line-associated bloodstream infection, which primarily is a problem in the ICU, since the vast majority of patients who have central lines are in the ICU. And interventions in the ICU usually look quite different than those outside of the ICU. In the ICU, they tend to be closed, confined spaces where there's a physician leader, a nurse leader, or a nurse manager. We know who the identified people who are responsible are. There's usually a small number of physicians and nurses. And, of course, the patient-to-nurse ratio in the ICU is 1-to-1 or 2-to-1. So interventions there, then, even though it's not easy, at least it's straightforward. I think when you're talking about something like catheter-associated urinary tract infection, because it touches on so many different parts of the hospital, it's much more complex. But those are the types of complexities that will need to be understood to prevent other hospital-acquired complications, such as Clostridium difficile infection, which in our hospital and in the United States, unfortunately, continues to be a problem and is a growing problem for elderly patients and who can have terrible outcomes very quickly. In fact, in the last year, I've had two of my own patients die because of Clostridium difficile infection that was acquired during hospitalization. And the ways to prevent C. diff infection are the technical aspects are more like CAUDI, in that there's no silver bullet. There's nothing that is the equivalent to putting chlorhexidine gluconate into the tray, which would reduce CLABSI rates by 50%. For C. diff infection, it would be antibiotic stewardship and only giving antibiotics if needed, which is very much a behavioral change challenge. Proper cleaning of the room, both daily cleaning as well as terminal cleaning with a particular type of product that contains bleach. Early detection and cohorting of patients so we don't spread it to other patients, plus other types of interventions that really involve different types of providers, nurses, physicians, people who clean the rooms, microbiologists, infection preventionists. And it also, with C. diff, requires us to think differently about hand hygiene, something that, you know, work by Benedetta and Didier Pettet and others have been so important in the importance of alcohol-based hand rub for hand hygiene. But if you have a patient, of course, who has Clostridium difficile, now we have to say to ourselves, no, the alcohol-based hand rub is not acceptable. We have to now go and find that sink and use soap and water. So we hope that what we're learning will apply to Clostridium difficile, as well as non-infectious complications such as falls, delirium, contrast-induced nephropathy, any type of complication that seems messy and that involves patients in different parts of the hospital.
Many, many thanks once again for these additional examples. And, of course, we are looking forward to your further publications in this field that will come for sure numerous in the future. So I would like to invite the audience to go more in depth on this topic, in particular by looking at your key indications that you cited and are available. And then I would like to conclude by reminding the audience that we are mid-April, heading to 5th of May, the day when WHO every year celebrates hand hygiene improvement and efforts around the world, hoping to overcome the gaps that still exist in this field, as you highlighted, from the behavioral change aspect in particular, but also in other areas, such as the limited availability of alcohol-based hand rubs in low-middle-income countries, for instance. So I would like to invite the audience to look at our website, join us with your initiatives, and also, in particular, join us with the next teleclass included in our series, which will be a special lecture by Professor Didier Pittet from Geneva. Most likely this presentation will be made on 7th of May at 2:30 p.m. Central Europe time, 8:30 a.m. New York time. In any case, for sure, on that day, it will be available on Weber Training. This presentation, obviously, will be an update about hand hygiene efforts around the world, and in particular this year, I believe, will be particularly interesting because it will show you for the first time the results of a global survey we have undertaken on hand hygiene promotion activities and resources worldwide. So please join us on 5th of May and 7th of May with celebrations and participation in this teleclass. And thank you once again to Weber Training for hosting us and to all of you for listening today. Have a good day or have a good evening in Europe. Thank you. Goodbye.